Welcome to The Dreaming. I'm Joe Foljam.
I'm Sasha Smulders. This is The Sandman, Issue 17, Calliope.
Welcome to Dream Country. We are in the Dream Country trade paperback for most people, I think. I don't think there are going to be very many people reading this exactly issue by issue, because you're going to pick it up in these trade paperback collected editions. And here we are with a bunch of standalone stories, as mentioned. This one's a little rough in spots.
I'm going to be glad that this one's a standalone and this character won't come back.
Well, it's not that this character won't. Oh, you mean Rick Maddock. Rick Maddock, yeah, he's not featured ever again. No,
yeah.
That's true.
I have a laundry list of things I hope this character did after the final pages of this comic.
Yeah, no doubt. So issue 17 was first released in July of 1990, written by Neil Gaiman, illustrated by Kelly Jones, colored by Daniel Vazzo, lettered by Todd Klein, associate editor Tom Payer, and editor Karen Berger. My summary for this issue is, a writer keeps the muse Calliope captive, abusing her for her ability to inspire creativity. She is finally able to seek help from Morpheus, former lover and father of her son.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to talk about. But let's get to the cover here. Really beautiful piece of artwork by Dave McKean here of Calliope.
So we have a woman standing and her arms are crossed across her chest, which Calliope does in a variety of poses throughout the issue itself.
Yeah. In the Dust Covers book that I have that talks about the Sandman covers, Neil Gaiman notes that Dave McKean would basically set down rules for the way that each story arc's covers would work.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew that this kind of arc of individual stories would be called Dream Country.
Mm-hmm.
And he had decided, he was very inspired by American illustrator and educator Baron Story. Story is probably most widely known for his cover portraits from Time. His Howard Hughes and Yitzhak Rabin hang in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery.
Mm.
And here I've got them for you to take a look at right here. There is the Howard Hughes one. It's a shot of Howard Hughes quite old and frazzled, done in this really cool art style. And there is Premier Yitzhak Rabin. And this is the first of those, and it's acrylic, ink, varnish, and peacock feathers. So that is an actual peacock feather, not a painting of a peacock feather.
It's a series of peacock feathers.
Yeah, or
one,
yeah,
it's a large one on the right, and then a bunch of the smaller ones all stacked on each other. Well, the ends of them all stacked on each other on the left-hand side. The title on it almost looks like it's been cut out. Like, I could imagine it being, I can see that it's probably like the white has been scraped, like has been painted across in a long strip.
Mm-hmm.
But it also looks like something someone would cut out of a sign, like a wrought iron sign,
well,
or something.
It looks like he's maybe put some kind of cover over top of it before the white went.
Yeah.
I know that there are techniques you can do to do that, where maybe you could,
like a stencil. Yeah.
Yeah, put a stencil down or put some wax over it.
Mm-hmm.
And the wax you can then melt off later.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it looks like he's done that to get that inverse there. It's really cool. Yeah. Or it could just be drawn over top, now that I look at it, because the P in Calliope does drop down outside of the white. So he might have just done the big swath and then painted over top to get that cool effect.
Maybe. Yeah.
It looks great. That is another aspect of this story arc's style, is that the title is actually in the artwork.
Yeah, it hasn't been in the artwork yet.
Right. No, you're going to see that in all of these Dream Country covers.
In the Absolute Sandman collection, which I'm reading from, there is a second page alongside the title, and it has two quotes in it.
Right.
The first quote is by Arthur Machen in a letter written to James Branch Cabell, the 17th of February, 1918. "I do not know whether you know all that is to be known concerning small mirrors, but of this, silence."
Okay.
It's a bit of a weird sentence.
Yeah.
And then the second quote is by Erasmus Fry in conversation on the 6th of May, 1986.
Okay.
"Writers are liars."
Yeah, Neil says that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Does Fry say that inside this? I think he does.
I think he does, yes.
I've been reading the digital edition rather than the absolute edition. It doesn't actually have that those quotes in it, that page on it. But while researching, I did note that there was a page that was planned to be, two pages that were planned to be opposite of each other. Mm-hmm. But because of the way that the ad placements and stuff turned out, like normally you would know you're going to have a ad, this page is going to be ads and that mm-hmm. page is going to be ads. So you'll kind of be able to take that into account and know which ones will face each other. Neil had wanted those to end up printed opposite each other so mm-hmm. that parts of them would mirror the other pages. Set up so that mm-hmm. you could compare them and see them together as a whole. But the ads in this, when it even went out, the ads ended up being all in the wrong place.
Oh no.
So even the initial printing didn't have them properly opposite. And also with no ads, they don't end up paired up together
okay.
in a book. So it seems like what they've done in that is maybe added an extra page.
Yeah.
So that specifically these two pages will line up. I'll point them out when we get to them.
Mm-hmm.
May 1986, and we meet Richard Maddock, Dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. It's reasonable.
Yeah.
Reasonable name.
Somebody's bringing him what he was asking for. It's a bezoar. Bezoar is a mass found trapped in the gastrointestinal system, though it can occur in other locations. And it comes from the Persian padzar. And the two syllables mean protect or guardian and poison. And they were believed to be a protector against poison. Trichino is the Greek stem for hair.
Mm-hmm.
And trichinobezoar seems to kind of be an alternate spelling of the more common or perhaps an incorrect spelling. I can't really find out which of them
okay.
because it's in this Neil Gaiman Sandman. So when you search for it, you now find it as
yeah.
a spelling. It seems to be an alternate spelling for the more common trichobezoar. Wikipedia notes that trichobezoars are rare, but can be fatal if undetected, and surgical intervention is often required.
So a mass of hair that is still in your stomach.
It's a hairball that is so compressed together that you can't pass it, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. In the script, Gaiman describes the trichobezoar as a fossilized tribble covered in slime.
Ugh.
Also, I'll note on this page, the doctor says it's technically called Rapunzel syndrome. He's wrong. It's technically called trichophagia.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, doctor, I'm going to have to correct you there.
Be colloquially called.
Yeah, it is called Rapunzel syndrome, I guess.
Rapunzel didn't eat her hair. She hung it out a window and let a dude climb up it.
Yeah, Rapunzel syndrome is when you build useful household items out of your hair, like ladders.
Or sweaters.
That would be Rapunzel syndrome.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that syndrome right there.
You like girl braid and then whip people with it.
Mm-hmm. Richard Maddock has asked this doctor for a bezoar.
Mm-hmm. And also, I'm going to note, the doctor, he's just got it right in his hands. He's not even wearing gloves.
Mm-hmm.
He's just okay with holding this
yeah.
disgusting, smelly hairball.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, they're pretty gross. And he's like, yeah, here you go.
Like, at least a cat hairball, that didn't go all the way to the cat's stomach, did it? That just kind of, like, collected somewhere. Maybe
oh, I don't know.
In the stomach. I don't know.
I don't know.
It's bad. I wouldn't pick it up with my hands.
This is a thing I could look up on cat hairballs and how they work, and then I could inform all our listeners, but I'm not gonna. It's
yeah.
not information I think I need to know. But if somebody else would like to, you should Google how hairballs work
yeah.
in cats, and then that might be interesting.
Make your own hairball podcast?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll save that for the hairball podcast. Turns out the doctor's a fan of Richard Maddock, who's a writer.
He is. He's a real fan of his first book. He's so excited mm-hmm. to get that autograph. And he obviously, well, not obviously, but I can imagine he went to some trouble to get this thing for him, this disgusting thing for him.
Well, he does say, you know, what do I owe you, Felix? He says, oh, nothing. It just would have been incinerated or popped in a jar for students to stare at. So I don't think it was that big a deal. I think they're just medical waste and probably wouldn't be too hard for him to just, you know, put in a bag.
I guess.
Take it out with him.
I mean, it's supposed to be destroyed though, right? He might have broken some rules to get him this.
Yeah. I don't know how dangerous something like this would be.
Okay.
Unless the person was actually ill of something else.
I guess.
I don't know.
Sense.
I'm not a doctor, but I can't imagine something non-cancerous. Like it's just a lump of hair. I mean, it's gross for sure, but it's probably dried out by now, even though it looks slimy and gross and they want it like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you Google for photos of these, which I have, they look pretty dry. Like it's just a gross kind of, it's kind of like a dreadlock.
Okay.
Like a really, really dense dreadlock. So there are little bits of gross hair sticking out of it, but like, you know, you're just holding the dreadlock. So you'd just be like this. You'd be going, holding it, going, yeah, and this isn't pleasant, but it's not like it's going to eat me or make me sick.
It's so charming, the things you get to Google.
Yeah.
And then because I'm not allowed to know the things you're Googling because Joe researches before I've read the thing. Yeah. I just have to assume if I walk past you on your computer and you're looking at something really weird, I just have to be like, don't ask about it. I'm sure it's a spoiler and you don't want to know. Or you just don't want to know.
There's so much porn in upcoming Sandman issues.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what that's for. So he asked for just an autograph for The Cabaret of Dr. Caligari.
Mm-hmm.
That is a reference to the 1920 silent German horror film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's considered the quintessential work of German expressionist cinema.
This is Dick's only novel so far. And obviously it was at least a mild success because he did get signed to do another book.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, he's over 9 months past the due date for that book. And if movies and books about writers have taught me anything, it's that you don't want to be past that date.
He's probably been living off the money they gave him on the advance.
Yep.
So he's desperate. Mm. Desperate to retain what he had.
Mm.
Willing to do anything.
Hmm.
And he hasn't even written a word. He's just got total writer's block. So we see him walking. This is, we find out, I didn't know this, but these are the streets of London. These are based on reference photos that Neil took of the Chelsea Thames area of London.
Okay.
And that weird fishy thing that you see in the left-hand side of the panel is actually called a dolphin lamp standard.
Oh.
And it's the base of a really cool dolphin, of a really cool lamppost along the Thames.
I saw it and I went, ooh, a Magikarp.
It kind of does look like that, yeah. But a real place, so it's kind of showing you where that is. A real photo showing you where that stuff's from. This is the first appearance of Erasmus Fry. He is not a character that's existed anywhere before.
I thought he might be a real author and that Neil was like throwing real shade on him.
Oh, wow.
Like, hey, I wouldn't put it past Neil to do that.
Well, if there's anybody based on a real author here, I think it's actually Richard Maddock and kind of Clive Barker's wild rise to stardom.
I don't know who Clive Barker is.
Hellraiser.
Oh, I like... is that like Pinhead?
Yeah, Pinhead, Hellraiser. Clive Barker wrote that. He's wildly popular in horror comics.
Okay.
He's wildly popular in horror novels. Yeah.
I've never read any of his books, and I've only seen a couple scenes from Pinhead. It just didn't really appeal to me.
I didn't like Hellraiser, but Clive Barker's very good. And there was actually this Clive Barker video game called Undying that I was actually really fond of.
Okay.
It's like a horror 3D game. Really good. I don't know much about him. I haven't read a lot myself, but I have read is he's a very talented writer.
And Neil Gaiman is throwing some serious shade at him.
No, he's not saying, I don't think he's saying you got your creativity by, trigger warning, by the way.
Trigger warning on this whole issue. Terrible. Sorry we didn't do that at the beginning.
I
can do that separately.
I
can record a second one.
There's some bad stuff going on in this comic. So Richard Maddock meets Erasmus Fry, and Erasmus Fry likes to talk.
He also has talons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got pretty long fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just looks like a decadent old man, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Like he's smiling.
I think he's wearing
so
a cravat.
I think he is. Yeah.
At first, I thought it was like a metal t-shirt in that first shot of him. Well, I guess the second shot of him where he's... like crouched or something, like what is he doing in that? And then I just thought maybe it was like a t-shirt that was like a bunch of skulls, and then in later panels it looks fluffy, and also he has like fluffy wrists on his shirt too, so it's just a fluffy shirt. It's like a shirt with ruffles. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Ruffles, not fluffy.
Yeah,
it's a ruffle shirt.
Yeah, he's wearing a puffy pirate shirt.
Yeah
he's totally old-fashioned.
Mm.
And he also talks about Bezoars, comes from Persian. Padzar, he's totally right, means counter poison.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly found in the stomachs of goats and gazelles. Not entirely true, actually.
No?
We found all sorts of places, yeah. Well, I mean, that's where Persians found it, for sure.
Well, he just likes to ramble on about
He does. He's got all sorts of talking. Queen Elizabeth I had a Bezoar set in gold with unicorn's horn given to her by John Dee, her spy and magician.
John Dee.
John Dee. John Dee is a real person. Well, yeah.
Mm. I'm sure there's plenty of people who have been named John Dee over the years.
John Dee was an English mathematician, astronomer, astrologer, occult philosopher, and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. He devoted much of his life to the study of alchemy, divination, and hermetic philosophy.
So that's where they got the name for Mr. Mm-hmm. Terrible Ruby Stealing Cranky Pants?
Dr. Destiny. John Dee. Same name, yeah.
Okay. Bringing it back.
Bringing it back. Yeah. And also D is for dream. D is for lots of things.
Person that I dislike but feel a little bit sorry for. But mostly I dislike.
Who?
John Dee.
Oh, John Dee. Yeah, yeah.
I have a tinkling of empathy for him.
And Maddox hates that he keeps talking because he's talking about all sorts of creative stuff and wonderful stories. And Maddox has not written a word in a year. Do you know what that's like? He says, of course, I know what it's like. Don't be a fool, boy. Mm. Let me see my present. And then he goes on talking some more.
I think this reaction from him is like, no, old man, I'm young and my problems are real. Yeah. Your loneliness doesn't matter. And the fact that you never talk to anyone. Exactly. And so you're finally getting a captive audience. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I am young and all of my little minuscule experiences mean so much. Whiny baby.
Yeah. Not that the wisdom that Erasmus Fry has seems to make him a better person.
No.
Because
Erasmus Fry is a terrible person?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's the OG terrible person.
He is OG terrible. And he mentions, I caught her on Mount Helicon, 1927, Greece. I was 27 at the time. In Greek mythology, Mount Helicon was considered the home of Apollo and the Muses. So totally fitting. Mm-hmm. It contains two springs that are sacred to the Muses. One of them is named the Hippocrene, which literally translates to horse spring. The legend is that it was formed when Pegasus's hoof struck the rock so hard that it caused the spring to burst forth.
Yeah.
So it was a spring caused by Pegasus smacking it with its hoof.
That's my kind of spring.
Moly, that he mentions trapping her with.
Mm-hmm.
That is a magical herb mentioned in Book 10 of Homer's Odyssey.
Oh.
There's some mystical mumbo jumbo about it. There's a few. There are some arguments over which real herb he's talking about, but might not be any.
Fancy magic garlic.
Yeah, it's magic sorcerer's garlic for sure.
I'm just gonna say, if you're gonna trap me with anything, garlic is successful, especially if you've put it in pretty much any food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Or just roasted it.
Yeah. Yeah.
With olive oil.
Garlic hummus.
We're going to take a break to eat now. I don't need her anymore, Matic, and you do. Here she is.
Ugh.
Her name is Calliope.
And we get a second title page, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. We get the title on the cover, and we get it again. Calliope is the muse of eloquence and epic poetry. She is the mother of Orpheus, his father either being the god Apollo or King Oeagrus of Thrace. Later, though, it seems that Dream is Orpheus's father.
Mm.
Later in this comic, because we find out. We'll get to the mention that basically clinches that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the full page shot of her, you can just see where the light is touching her as the door is opened. And the page before where Erasmus is opening the door, he's opening it to a dark room. So that really struck me, is that she is just in there on her knees in the dark.
Yeah. Or perhaps she's walking around on her knees, yeah, like to safely get around. I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, or she might have been lying down.
Just nothing else to do in there.
Yeah.
It's dark.
Yeah, he treats her terribly. At the end of Dream Country, I don't know if anybody's looked ahead, but there actually is the script for this issue at the end of the Dream Country collection. It's not in the Absolute Sandman you have. On page 6, we actually have Neil's description of Calliope.
Okay.
Splash page, dark border on the page. We're looking straight through the open door. Possibly the panel border is the doorway. And we're looking at is apparently a thin 15 or possibly just 16-year-old girl. She's standing there staring at us. She has beautiful face with deep cheekbones. She's a goddess, after all, and a thin body. She looks as if she's been starved for a couple of weeks. We can see the outline of her hip bones and not quite count her ribs. She's naked. She looks very vulnerable. This is the vulnerability of nakedness. If you've ever seen any photos of famine victims or concentration camp victims, there's a point at which nakedness totally ceases to titillate, instead just arouses feelings of pity. Bill Sienkiewicz caught it perfectly in the mental hospital sequences in Electra Assassin No. 1, he adds parenthetically. Either she has her hands on her opposite shoulders, hugging herself, or she's covering her breasts with one arm, or reaching down her other hand, covering her pubic area with a hand. It's not false modesty, it's a wish to protect herself from. She doesn't look scared, nervous perhaps, or unhappy more like. She also has masses of shaggy blondish hair down to the small of her back. The key here is vulnerability. This shouldn't look titillating, it's not a hubba hubba kind of naked woman shot. It's one that it almost hurts to look at. Tear their hearts out, Kelly. She's lit by the muted bulb in the hall. Dimly behind her, we might be able to make out a cheap camp bed with a thin blanket on it. At the bottom of the panel, preferably in the kind of lettering we had for the title of number 7, is the title. So there's Neil giving the instructions to the artist on what to display. And we also get a note there that Neil has added later that Kelly drew Calliope as really skinny with horribly protruding ribs. And Karen Berger felt it was way too extreme. And so the inker actually inked her a little less skinny.
Yeah.
Which is also why this whole thing is a little darker than it originally was. Giving very big guidelines to not turn this into a hubba hubba show. To
That you're not really, supposed to.
Right. That yes, this is a goddess and is gorgeous, but these are pity shots.
It's not What's a rape happening. Fantasy.
Right, absolutely.
It's a survivor's story.
Even more when he describes her responding, even though she has nothing that she can do, he notes that she's always completely noble about it, that she's, let me find. Over on page 7, the next page over, panel 1, where she says, what would you with me now, Erasmus? Neil describes her. We're looking at Calliope in close-up, a face shot, shadowy, as she stares straight out at us. She's come out of the room and is now in the hallway, so the light is directly above her, casting low shadows from her nose and across her eyes. I tend to imagine her as a starved young Brigitte Bardot, but that's possibly because there's a Brigitte Bardot movie on late-night TV right now. She has a combination of grandeur and innocence here, but obviously hates Erasmus, is counting the days and the hours until her imprisonment is over. He may have her spirit, but he doesn't have her soul, and she says. And then it's her line. So Neil is, very firmly setting up guidelines to the artists about how this is to be presented.
What would you with me now, Erasmus? Am I now to perform for your amusement? Is this man to be our audience?
Don't get yourself all worked up, Calliope. No, this is Richard Maddock. He's a novelist, or at least he's written one extremely successful first novel and has found himself quite unable to write anything else. Richard, this is Calliope, the youngest of the 9 muses. She was Homer's muse, so she ought to be good enough for you. Calliope, I'm giving you to Richard. You're his now.
But you said, you told me, you promised me that you would free me before you died. You said I could have my freedom.
Put not your trust in princes, my dear. Put not your trust in princes is from Psalms 146, verse 3. Put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. Or in the New International Version, do not put your trust in princes, in human beings, who cannot save. Basically, humans can't save you from going to hell.
Sure. I'm going to read it as don't trust man.
Yeah, that's kind of what he's saying. I'm human. Humans lie.
Don't trust scrubs. Don't do it.
I don't want no scrubs.
A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Sitting on the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holler at me.
Erasmus Fry is a scrub.
He's worse than a scrub, actually. Scrub is like basically a mild insult compared to what a wretched human being he is.
So Fry is just letting her go. I guess he's done with his writing, so he doesn't. So in his mind, he doesn't need her anymore. I don't know how the trade is at all fair. He basically got a hairball. In exchange for inspire you to be brilliant muse?
I think he just wanted rid of her.
I think so. Take the little cow away. She hates him, so I guess, yeah.
And he maybe can't. It's implied within this, like obviously we're getting to some pretty heavy trigger warning stuff, but like it's implied that in order to get the whatever the muse gives you, you have to have sex with her,
well,
right?
Traditionally, you had to woo a muse.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't know if you exactly had to have carnal intercourse, but there would have to be like a romantic love or something between the two of you. You would woo amuse, and she would give you her affections, which would give you the inspiration. Yes.
And in this, because both of them have taken her against her will, like the implication is that they have to rape her in order to get that info. And Erasmus is an old man now. Maybe he can't do it anymore, and he doesn't want to keep her around because it's a reminder of how he can't get it up.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
That's probably it.
Oh, poor old man. Can't rape this poor innocent woman anymore. Oh, I really feel for him. My heart. It bleeds for him.
However, if you happen to feel a spark of gratitude, you might want to persuade some publisher to bring Here Comes a Candle back into print. I was particularly proud of that one. Here Comes a Candle comes from the traditional English nursery rhyme and singing game Oranges and Lemons, which refers to the bells of several churches, all within or close to the city of London. In the game, which the singing game is a lot like the London Bridges game, I don't know if you've ever done that, where you would steeple your heads, and they would kind of go up and down with it, and at the end of the story, the two arms would come down over somebody's neck, around somebody's neck, as though it was being cut off, and the final lines are, "Here comes a candle to light you to bed, and here comes a chopper to chop off your head."
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a little children's version of that.
"Say the bells of St. John's, kettles and pans, say the bells of St. Anne's, brickbats and tiles, say the bells of St. Giles, here comes the candle to light you to bed, and here comes the chopper.
Now, is it all like little children's stories and songs that are based on the grossest, darkest things, or is it particularly British ones?
Well, so Oranges and Lemons is a very old song.
Yeah.
And the original versions don't have that last few lines.
Okay.
And all the verses ahead are just rhymes with the churches. So Oranges and Lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens, you owe me 5 farthings. Say the bells of St. Martin's. When will you pay me? Say the bells of Old Bailey. When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch. It's just that.
You're just naming the churches.
And it's just naming the churches, and it's a nice rhyming scheme so you can remember them all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kids would be taught this song, and then they'd play their songs or play their games while singing these rhyming songs because they're stuck in their head because they're kids and this is all that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, people are getting their heads cut off, so they think, well, that's when that ended up getting tacked onto those songs.
I'm just wondering if it's, you don't have to be able to answer this for me, but I'm just wondering into the void if it's like, if it's in particular, if it's the English that have twisted children that sing those kinds of things. I say being half English myself.
I don't know.
Or if it's universal. Is it like universal that children's songs just become the darkest twisted thing? Or is that unique to the British Isles?
I'm not. We would need an expert in historical children's songs.
Historian. Yeah.
My guess is most cultures' kids probably add in hilarious lines about gruesome activities.
Yeah.
So yeah, Here Comes a Candle, Oranges and Lemons, and now I know that. Now that I know where that's from, Oranges and Lemons, it's not ever going to get on my head.
Mm-hmm. Earworm forever.
Oh boy.
I'd like to notice here as well. Dick forgets to bring clothing to take Calliope home in.
Yeah.
And luckily for him, Erasmus has a trench coat. And so you see Dick wrapping Calliope in the trench coat. And then later on, when he is writing in his study, he's wearing that trench coat. I'm pretty sure that that's what he's wearing.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Because showing that he took it away from her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's get over to that page and get this over with.
As much as what's happening is really terrible, I think what Neil chose to put in this script is very interesting. She's not even human, he told himself. She's thousands of years old. And it occurred to him momentarily that the old man might have cheated him, given him a real girl, that he, Rick Maddock, might possibly have done something wrong, even criminal.
Yeah.
And I think what that strikes as closer to our real world is that there are people out there, there's a lot of people out there who can only imagine rapists and people who abuse intimate partners as being monsters, and so then they can't see, they don't even see themselves as rapists. They would never label themselves as that.
Right.
And so, like, it can come from certain things of just not, like, caring about women's experiences, but also just not thinking women are fully fleshed people, thinking you own them, and even just reading their, reading what they do in that situation as as compliant enough because they can't leave, then that's enough, right? And it's not necessarily a strictly violent thing. And because they only believe it to be that, that's why there is this sadly too large group of people out there who continue to do this and don't understand it and have a cognitive dissonance that protects them.
Oh yeah, this is how human beings make up excuses for their own behavior all the time.
Like this character, I'm sure if he heard of someone in his life having been raped or would probably talk about it as if it was so terrible and awful and yet is doing this because he has created his own story for why it's okay because she's not even human.
Right, as if that makes a difference.
Yeah.
She's like a thinking, sentient, communicating entity.
Yeah.
That's enough to have rights to not be raped. Yeah. And in the writing room that Richard Maddock has there, Neil notes in the script that he sent Kelly some photos of his workspace to give him an idea of what he had in mind, and he reproduced it embarrassingly accurately, minus a Groucho Marx statue. So aside from a Groucho Marx statue that Neil had somewhere in there, that's what Neil's workspace looked like back at that time.
And just like that, Rick can write again.
Yeah.
And even the one shot of what Rick has been writing is specifically like a violent, not like a woman cutting her own face.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but it's just, it's yucky.
Yeah. And over the next page, page 9, we have Calliope calling out for help. Gracious ladies, mother of Achaemenae, hear my prayer. So what Neil's done here is not traditional for Greek myth. It kind of contradicts most of the classical sources. The Achaemenae are the Roman equivalent to the Muses, so she's calling out to the mothers of the Muses. In the script, Neil notes that earlier versions of Muses had only 3 women rather than the traditional 9. So in a way, the 3 was the mother of the 9 Muses.
Okay.
And so he's doing that to tie the 3 in 1 to kind of be the mother of the Muses, including Calliope, which is not traditional, but you know, totally what you're allowed to do.
Yeah.
These are also the 2 pages that Neil wanted to be face-to-face, opposite each other, and you can see how they line up, how you've got 3s all over the place, and the way things work like that. Yeah, it looks much better this way than it would some other way if they were split up, for sure.
At no point in these 2 pages are the 3 ever depicted not all in the same panel. They never separate them. The 3 are always together.
But they're moving around. Rarely in the same place. Sometimes, though. But at least 2 of them have switched places at some point. Yeah. We have some reveals here.
Yeah.
First off is that the three also cannot break rules. That she was snared upon the Helicon. According to the mysteries, you are lawfully bound. So there's some kind of rules going on. So there's these entities with lots of power, but they all follow rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are few of the old powers willing or able to meddle in mortal affairs these days, Calliope. Many gods have died, my daughter, while aspects of other gods have been lost forever. Only the endless will never die, and even they are having a difficult time of late. Still, every little bit helps, as the old woman said when she pissed into the sea. That line right there, I say all the time because of this comic.
Yeah?
Yeah, all the time. I love it. A little bit helps, said the old woman as she pissed into the sea. It's an old English proverb, apparently. The endless, now there's a thought. After all, the Dream King and Calliope were close long ago for a short while, weren't you, my pet? Not for long, and remember, Sister Self, they did not part on the best of terms, but she did bear his cub, that boy child who went to Hades for his lady love and died in Thrace, torn apart by the Sisters of the Frenzy for his sacrilege. Right yeah. there, we find out that's Orpheus.
Okay. I don't know much about Orpheus.
We're going to find out more about Orpheus later.
Okay.
But Orpheus was basically the Greek version of a super bard.
Okay, cool.
He was an amazing musician and singer.
Mm-hmm.
And his lady love died on their wedding night.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I'm going to go to Hades and ask for him to give her back. And he made his way there, amazingly, and sung a song so sweet that Hades said, okay, I will let you have your lady love back. But you have to walk out of Hades facing that way and never look back. And if you look back, you will lose her forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so he walked out of Hades. But as he walked, he started to, wait a minute, he's fooling me. I'm totally going to get fooled. And she's not behind me at all. I can't hear a single thing. And eventually, just before he reached the exit, he turned around and saw her. And she was there. And then she was pulled back and lost forever. And then later on, he becomes terribly depressed. Eventually, the Maenads, kind of the kindly ones,
okay,
mad worshippers of Dionysus, but mm-hmm. can also be tied into the mad, angry version of the three,
mm-hmm.
For his blasphemy, killed him. But because of his divine heritage or something, he didn't die. They tore his head off and they threw it into the river, and his head floated away singing. And that's kind of the Orpheus story.
I know the part of the story where he goes back, he goes to Hades mm-hmm. to get his wife and then walks out and then turns around. And now I thought, isn't that the one where she turns into a pillar of salt or something?
No, that's Job.
That's Job.
Job is similar as well.
Yeah. Same Job story, like, don't different look outfit. Back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same story, new outfit.
Yeah.
These stories are all the same. If anything, Neil is just, you know, pointing that out. These stories are all the same.
We also get another name. I don't think we've called him this yet, have we? Oneros? Oneros is probably the more accurate. But
Oneros?
Yeah, it's Greek.
Oneros.
Yeah, it's basically Greek for dream.
Okay. But the gist of this conversation is that the three in one say, well, you could call Dream, but he's kind of busy. I'm not sure he'd help you.
He's in prison.
And Calliope says, no, don't call him. Like, oh my God, don't call my ex. I don't want to talk to him.
Yeah.
And then the three say, well, it's not like he could really help you anyway. He's got mm-hmm. his own problems and he probably wouldn't. And then she kind of relents and it's like, please send someone. I guess if you have to, you could send him.
Even Oneros.
Mm-hmm. Just as long as you send somebody.
Yeah. And then she blames herself. It had been her own fault, which is what often happens. Blaming yourself. It's your own fault. How could you have known?
Yeah.
Come on. She returns and there he is. We see the young Erasmus Fry looking just as creepy.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yeah.
He looks like the Joker.
A little. Yeah. A little like the man who laughs for sure.
Mm-hmm. Still a creep. I also think that character is a creep.
Yeah. Rick Matta comes back. He's finished his second novel. It's called My Love, She Gave Me Light. 2 drafts in 5 weeks. My Love, She Gave Me Light is actually from a riddle that appears in Neil Gaiman's comic, The Books of Magic. And in it, the character, the fool, is riddling Tim Hunter, who's kind of Neil's version of... Neil's superhero version of Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
even though Tim Hunter came out before Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
There's total similarities if anybody hasn't seen this. Like, so much so that people are like, why aren't you going to sue her for that?
And Neil
was like, oh yeah, he's a young English boy with round spectacles who is magically amazingly good at magic, like, and has this destiny. Yeah.
Huh.
So in it, these super powerful magical entities from the DC universe go around and teach him things.
Okay.
And one of them is Mr. E. It's a terrible name, Mr. E, Mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. E has been so overwhelmed by dark forces and has been fighting them so long, he basically can only think the worst of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he fights against the powers of evil, but he just can't ever see anything innocent anymore.
Okay.
The fool asked Tim Hunter and Mr. E this riddle. A riddle. I sat with my love, and I drank with my love, and my love, she gave me light. I'll give any man a pint of wine that'll read my riddle right, only I don't have a pint of wine. Do you give up? And Mr. E says, it is an evil rhyme, and it has an evil answer. Oh, so, says the fool, but can you riddle it? And Mr. E, getting the joke, I think, wrong, says, I sit in a chair made of my love's bones, drank from her skull, and saw by the light of a candle made from her fat. There, are you satisfied, fool? Let us leave this place. But the actual answer is a bottle of wine, because you sat with your bottle of wine, you drank with your bottle of wine, and then you put a candle in it, and it gave you light. But you don't have a bottle of wine anymore because you drank it.
Ah, okay. So my love is the wine and
is
not...
Is the bottle of wine.
And is the bottle
your love
of wine
is,
and
your
not
love
a
is
woman.
The wine.
And
yeah.
And Mr. E makes the assumption that the love is a woman and that this person has brutally murdered her and then turned her body into all the implements
within the
riddle.
Yeah, because
that
fits, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh.
And Neil alludes to his own little thing there with my love, she gave me light. And knowing Rick Maddock, it's probably the gruesome part rather than the bottle of wine part.
Yeah.
She says, will you let me go? And he says, are you out of your mind? This is just the beginning. Come here, gorgeous. Let's make 2.5 minutes of squelching noises. That's actually a reference to a quote from the Sex Pistols' Johnny Lydon, also known as Johnny Rotten, who once said, love is 2 minutes and 52 seconds of squelching noises. So I guess Richard Maddock gives 23 seconds less.
Mm-hmm. Neither of them would have been noted as particularly giving lovers, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wish guys who thought that just wore that shit in a t-shirt, you know, like every day. Just put that.
Yeah. Yeah. I will be unsatisfying in big letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he spells it out there. You're my possession. Until I tell you that you're free, don't forget it. You're my personal muse, sweetheart. Now, let's party.
Ugh. Yeah. Right?
Blah, garbage person. Garbage person.
Yeah.
And then on the next page, oh.
Success.
I was so excited when I read the last little bit of dialogue on this panel. It's a bunch of people talking about his work, but what sticks out to me most is the woman who is talking to Richard says, I loved your characterization of Eileen. There aren't enough strong women in fiction. And he says, actually, I do tend to regard myself as a feminist writer.
Yeah.
Oh, men who claim to be feminists but actually are fucking awful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have a guy like that in Canada named Guillaume Gomeshi. And
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was like super... It was super lefty, artsy guy for that purpose, but actually fucking awful.
And porn star James Dean.
Yeah,
The news broke last year. Yeah, awful.
Yeah, there's just a never-ending list of guys who wear that little self-appointed ally badge and then do awful things with it.
And it's followed up by a question that Neil and many writers get and kind of hate. So tell me, where do you get your ideas?
This captive woman in my house.
Yeah.
That I'm fucking awful to.
Yeah. This story is kind of Neil's answer to that.
Yeah.
Right? People ask Neil, where do you get your ideas? Oh, have you read Sandman number 17?
I have a person that I treat like a piece of meat. Mm-hmm. Only I treat meat better.
Yeah.
Than this person.
It's great. We have an awesome setup villain here because you hate this guy.
I hate him.
Yeah. Good. I think you're supposed to. Really, John, I don't see any way that a work of genre fiction could be nominated for the Booker Prize. The Booker Prize, fully titled the Man Booker Prize for Fiction, is a literary prize awarded each year for the best original novel written in the English language and published in the UK. From its inception, and certainly when this story was set, only Commonwealth, Irish, and Zimbabwean citizens were eligible to receive the prize. However, in 2013, that was opened to any English language novel, as long as it was published in the UK. The woman who's speaking of the beautiful book and the sheer richness of the material is wearing a pinhead shirt, which is a Clive Barker character.
I thought she looked a little underdressed for that party.
Yeah. And in the script, you'll notice that the book cover, And My Love Gave Me a Candle by Rick Maddock, R-I-C. He was Richard Maddock earlier. Now he's even dropped a K.
Yeah.
And Neil notes he's dropped a K on account of being cool. In panel three, they mention the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, which is a literati must-read. It's a weekly supplement to the great metropolitan newspaper, the Times of London.
Hmm.
And the collection title is, in Gaiman's words, an oblique James Branch Cabell reference, a chapter he never got around to writing in Figures of Earth.
The spirit who had half of everything?
Yeah.
Hmm. It was a lightweight project between real books.
Yeah. Ugh. And note the statue of Athena on his desk, if you'd like to get even angrier.
Oh, I did not see that.
Yeah.
I am angrier.
He's such a feminist.
And then later, he's accepting an award.
Yeah.
And he throws a stupid joke on it.
Yeah, so he got a joke that's a dig at another person, yeah. He buys a new house in Chelsea. He's busy on pre-production for the film, and most of the moving is done for him. He moves his most valuable possession himself, though, late one spring night.
Hmm. And in 1989, he's moved on to Hollywood. He's finally... He had signed the 3-film deal back in April, and now he's making those movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his new epic novel, Eagle Stones. Eagle Stones, or Aetites, are magical stones, or, well, they're claimed to be magical stones, said to prevent spontaneous abortion and premature delivery while shortening labor and parturition for a full-term birth. Mm. It's basically a type of hollow geode. And it has small loose pieces inside that will rattle when shaken.
Oh. Okay.
But he's obviously doing the magical part, I would think. The final panel of page 13 has his movie poster on a fence, which is a little odd, but let it fly. Rick Maddox and the Madness of Crowds, nominated for 3 Oscars, Best Original Screenplay, Best Director, Best Picture. That is taken from a Victorian book called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay.
Mm.
It's a debunking book. It points out a bunch of things that people believe are true but aren't. It's kind of an early skeptical book. Really, really written from that point of view. The subject of Mackay's debunking include alchemy, crusades, duels, economic bubbles, fortune-telling, haunted houses, the influence of politics and religion on the shapes of beards and hair, magnetizers, influence of imagination in curing disease, murder through poisoning, prophecies, popular admiration of great thieves, popular follies of great cities and relics. Scientist and astronomer Carl Sagan actually mentioned the book in his own discussion about pseudoscience, popular delusions, and hoaxes. Yeah. And the fantastic librarians and archivists over at archive.org actually have a scan of the entire book that you can leaf through and read. So I'm going to put a link up to that in the show notes at thedreaming.motivedust.com.
Now, when I looked at it, the first thing I thought was the cover of Queen's album, A Night at the Opera. Is that what that album's called?
A little, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like that.
And then Calliope has a visitor.
Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we see her wearing clothes other than the trench coat.
Well, I guess Rick Maddox's been gone for 2 months.
Yeah, so she found some clothes.
So I guess she was able to get out of the room and just grab something. They're probably, they're his clothes, I guess. Because they're too big. He probably doesn't really worry about feeding her because she's immortal.
Yeah.
Which is why she's wasted away to almost nothing.
Yeah. She won't actually die, but she'll be thin and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can tell that it's Morpheus because of the speech bubble.
Mm-hmm.
They spoke the truth. I was imprisoned. But as you can see, I am free now.
Make him give me my freedom. Make him let me go.
On this page in the script, Neil notes that he calls in the script Morpheus the Sandman, even though that's not his name.
Okay.
So he writes in the script, the Sandman does this, the Sandman does that, the Sandman does that.
Huh.
But that's not, he also notes in the little note, but that's not his name.
Hmm.
And yeah, we can see Maddox's new earring. And it's as he learns that Erasmus Fry has died, and the earring is actually an ankh.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a death symbol.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
He's on a program called The Book Nook.
The Book Nook.
And the interviewer wins best facial hair of the issue.
Neil actually has noted that this interviewer bears a striking resemblance to his friend and collaborator, Kim Newman.
Okay.
He's an English journalist, film critic, and fiction writer. And there's a shot of Kim Newman right there.
Yep. That's him. That looks just like him. Well, he wins best facial hair of the issue.
Hey, Kim Newman, we'll be sending you your best facial hair prize in the email.
Yeah.
So while talking after the book nook, we find out how Erasmus Fry died. He thought he died of old age, but he poisoned himself, which is quite funny because he had been asking for a Bezoar, which is supposed to protect you from poison.
Yeah, so was he planning on just drinking a bunch of poison but testing it with the Bezoar?
I wonder if there's kind of an untold story for us to figure out, which is that I feel like he was told he would die from poison. Like he, this is my, there's nothing in the story that says this. This is my feeling.
It's your headcanon.
That he was told that he would die from poison.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got to save myself from dying from poison because I don't want to die from poison. And then he gets to 90 and he goes, what am I doing with my life? It's all over. I can't do this anymore. And he poisons himself. Yeah. And the prophecy comes true.
I can dig that. Yeah.
You are all welcome to that story.
No, accepted headcanon.
Thank you.
Accepted.
Thank you. And we get another mention of Here Comes a Candle. Again, that was one of his favorites of his own. He mentioned it on leaving, and that was the one that he kind of wanted to get back into print.
And just, I think it's interesting the difference of response, how Richard is saddened and kind of shocked by this news. At least he's taken aback. Mm-hmm. But the interviewer, like the shot of his face when he's describing it, he's laughing. He looks so joyous to be talking about how funny. This old man is dead. And he is not reading the room when it comes to Rick's response at all.
You're totally right. And Rick walks home to his huge mansion and finds that he has a guest. As you would call him, Sandy, looking pretty punk.
Yeah, he's a lot uglier in this one.
Mm-hmm.
He's
in a bad mood.
Yeah, he's got ugly face.
This is him being angry, right?
Yeah, he's got active bitch face.
Yes. And we get Morpheus telling him to be quiet and says, I have come to request that you set her free.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it doesn't look like Dream can force him to do it, or maybe if he could, he's not allowed.
No, he can't break a contract.
He probably can't, break the rules. He's like, let her out. We get many stages of denial going on.
Mm-hmm.
Are you out of your mind? There's no woman here. Get out of here. Do you know who I am? There's a law against people like you. Are you going to call the police? Is that it? I don't understand. I need her. If I didn't have her, I wouldn't be able to write. I wouldn't have ideas. I can't forget yet, not now, maybe in a year or so. Look, I have money, an awful lot of money, and hold your tongue.
Yeah, I need her. Oh, but I have all this money.
Yeah.
I have to make one more book, but I'll totally get rid of her in a year. I'll give you, where is this coming? Like, there's just no logic to this at all.
Yeah. She has been held captive for more than 60 years, stripped of all possessions, demeaned, abused, and hurt. I know how she must feel. And you will not free her because you need the ideas? You disgust me, Richard Maddock. You want ideas. You want dreams. You want stories. Then ideas you will have. Ideas in abundance. And then he woke up.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to say here, Dream.
Hmm?
You got an idea that you spent 70 years trapped in a bubble.
Yes.
You were in a bubble for 70 years. True.
Yes.
She spent 70 years.
60, like, but yeah.
60 years being repeatedly raped by two awful men. And also, like, there's the implication that Erasmus, it wasn't just alone, right? Like, the first thing she says is, yo, did you come here to rape me in front of this dude? Right? Like, not that necessarily makes it any better or worse or any other kind of, it's just awful. And like, that's cool. I don't think you really know how she feels, Dream. No. Yeah. I don't think you do. You were in a bubble and that sucked, you know? Yeah. Props to that, being stuck in a bubble. Yeah. That was rough stuff. But I think she really wanted a bubble. I think she would have appreciated a bubble.
And also, if you want to get even kind of angrier at Dream about this, it kind of seems like before he had been imprisoned, he wouldn't know how she felt and might not actually show up to free her.
Because what? He thinks it's her fault that their son went off and did his own stuff?
You're lawfully bound. What do you want me to do?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to wear that helicone spring.
Yeah.
Like that.
Not allowed to put your little scroll of ownership down so you can go swimming in the spring.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I got feelings.
I know. It's okay. Yeah, Morpheus is not perfect. This is really, if anything, I think this is kind of like a first... Well, his first step was, gosh, yes, I can be somebody's friend. Like, really? These are the steps he's taken towards being decent.
Yeah.
At first, he's like, yes, I guess being somebody's friend is okay.
Mm.
And now he's like, yeah, it is bad when bad things happen to other people, and maybe I should do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
In that way, he's kind of like us as a society. Because we keep doing the same thing. We keep claiming to be good guys, but then when you look at it, we don't fix those problems.
Gosh, it's terrible that thing's happening to her. Huh. Maybe I have some kind of moral obligation to intervene when my ex-baby mama has been imprisoned and is being repeatedly raped and will probably be held for the rest of this guy's life and then passed on again and will never have freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I have some moral obligation to her.
I appreciate that Neil has let Calliope be the one to threaten him at the end here. Morpheus says you'll have dreams in abundance, and then poof, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets to give him the mic drop.
Yeah.
Like, you're fucked. You have met Oneros, whom the Romans call the Shaper of Form. He was once my lover, and he was the father of my son.
I didn't know you'd ever had a son. Like, you didn't even ask her?
Yeah. Well, she says, you know nothing about me, Richard Maddock. I am real, Richard. I am more than a receptacle for your seed or an inspiration for your tales. Yeah. And here he goes. And then the ideas cannot stop.
Yeah. He starts with the verbal diarrhea.
Yeah, I'm going to a party. You know, I could write a whole story at the party. Possibly something could have happened to the outside world, a Holocaust of some type. These people are partying against the darkness. He mentions a man who inherits a library card to the library in Alexandria. The library in Alexandria was the library in Alexandria, Egypt, which was one of the greatest some stores of knowledge at the time, and a great amount of it was lost in at least one big fire. Several instances of losses.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, back in Caustic Soda Podcast, on our libraries episode, we talk about the Library of Alexandria and its losses and what was there and stuff. So if you want to go check that out, causticsodapodcast.com.
I like the idea of a were-goldfish who transforms into a wolf at the full moon.
Yes. Two old women taking a weasel on a holiday. Griffins shouldn't marry. Vampires don't dance. A rose bush, a nightingale, and a black rubber dog collar. The fraternity of critics, in reality a dark brethren linked by profane rites and blood vows. To destroy an author, they sacrifice a child and perform a critical mass. Which is, critical mass is a great little play on words, because critical mass is, of course, what an amount of an element, especially a radioactive one, hits when it turns, when explodes with a nuclear explosion.
Mm-hmm.
A mass can also be a holy rite,
mm-hmm.
and that is a bunch of critics. So it's their critical mass.
Oh, I was going to say it's also when a bunch of cyclists, you show up en masse to ride in the street.
Oh,
basically,
yeah?
If you get enough bicycles altogether, your critical mass makes you protected from cars, and cars have to give you the streets and stop going because there are so many of you. They have to treat you with respect and give you distance.
Yeah.
It's quite fun, actually. I need Disney Pixar to get on two old women taking a weasel on holiday.
That could be the next short, yeah.
Yeah, like a sweet married couple. Two little old ladies who are sweet and married. And they have a little weasel.
Oh, that was Mr. Sandman that I started.
Yeah.
But yeah, that could be the song.
I don't know any song. Oh, Pop Goes the Weasel. Is that what you're going for?
No, I was just trying to do a little springy little in the background of the two women taking their weasel on a holiday. Just a little sound.
I need that. Pixar.
Yeah.
Give it to me.
So we've got more of his creative babbling. The Parthenon he mentions was the Temple of Athena in Athens and a classic of ancient architecture. The doctor who shows up, good grief, Richard Maddock, that's the doctor who got him the Bezoar at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that until I went for my second read-through.
Your second read-through, yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, this is the same doctor. And I noticed right away, there's some weird stuff going on with the wall behind him.
Well, he wrote on the wall with his blood because he had to get the ideas out.
But he doesn't say that until later. Yeah. But yeah, that was, I noticed that. At first, I thought he'd ripped his eyeballs out and stuck them on the wall, because between the two blotches, it looks like an eyeball stuck on the wall.
Yeah. No, there is some writing, and you can even see the word weasels in one spot.
Mm.
Yeah, that's him writing his words down. And he mentions here a sestina about silence using the keywords dark, ragged, never, screaming, fire, and kiss.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sestina is a fixed verse form consisting of six stanzas of six lines each, normally followed by a three-line envoi. And an envoi is a short stanza at the end of a poem used either to address an imagined or actual person or to comment on the preceding body of the poem.
Mm-hmm.
The words that end each line of the first stanza are used as line endings in each of the following stanzas, and they're rotated in a set pattern. So you'll have six lines that each end in six words. So he's providing those six words. Basically, every line would end in dark, ragged, never, screaming, fire, and kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And then which line for second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth that those would show up on would change mm-hmm. in each set of them. We've been trying to think of ways to thank our patrons on patreon.com/thedreaming who've been supporting this podcast, and kind of trying to think of some extra little things that we can do for them just as a hello and a thank you without, I don't want to withhold Sandman information.
No.
Right? I don't want that to be, but I'd like to provide something. We're going to do a special little recording of, I think, Neil Gaiman's Vampire Sestina.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in his book, Angels and Visitations. And I think it's in a few others as well. And it doesn't completely ascribe to the perfect sestina form, but it's really good. It's really fun. And I think we're going to have like just a little dramatic reading of that. And anybody who's a supporter at any level for us on patreon.com/thedreaming is going to have access to that. We'll put that up there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a week after this episode, though.
Yeah.
Give us some time to get that done, because we just had the idea.
Mm-hmm.
The Dr. Felix Garrison, FRCS, which is the Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, pulls him in and asks him what happens. What did you do to your hands? All the pictures in my head, I had to get them down, but I didn't have any paper or ink, so I used the wall and my fingertips. He just started writing them.
And his hands look like you can see they come to points sort of where the bone is exposed now.
A little too long in it feels like, I guess, well.
I don't know. If you ripped off the nail, the fingernail is what's giving the end of your finger shape.
Yeah.
So if you tore your fingernails off, and a bunch of the flesh, I imagine your fingers would come to points.
Hmm. You know? Ugh, terrible.
Yeah.
Looks gross. Mm. He drags it across his face because basically he's still in horrible agony right now.
Yeah. Do you think he's scratching his face, or he's just leaving a trail of blood on his face?
No, I think that's just a trail of blood in his face. I don't think he's actually scratching his face.
Yeah.
He mentions a few other things in his rantings here. He mentions cargo cults.
Mm-hmm.
Cargo cults were discovered among the peoples of the Pacific Islands during and after World War II based on the unbelievable amount of goods or cargo brought to these islands by the various armed forces. Basically, the people of these islands who didn't really know much about, you know, the Western world and technology and stuff just kind of started to understand that, oh, if you have like a landing strip that brings airplanes in, that makes everything better for you.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought that's how it happened, so that they would just start building these primitive airstrips, thinking that's what brought the gods who would bring the cargo down, when in reality it was just they didn't understand that it was the technology just used by people to bring the stuff that they had.
And that those islands were of great strategic importance to Americans during World War II.
Oh yeah, you had to land somewhere. You can fly just over the ocean all day.
Yeah.
Raymond Lull was a philosopher, logician, Franciscan tertiary, and Majorcan writer. He was the creator of a numerologic system which involved wheel-shaped diagrams with letters at the perimeter. And Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastes Paracelsus is better known as simply Paracelsus. And he was born Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastes von Hohenheim.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Swiss-German philosopher, physician, botanist, astrologer, and general occultist. He is credited as the founder of toxicology because he's one of the first people to actually look at chemicals as a reason for bad things happening to people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. I like Bombastes.
Yes, Bombastes.
Bombastes.
I'm the Bombastes.
I think that would make a great name for like a cat or something. Mm-hmm. Bombastus, and you just call him Bom Bom.
Bom Bom. Oh, I love it. Yes.
From me to you, listener.
There you go.
Getting a new cat, name it Bombastus. Already have a cat and are kind of sick of its name, name it Bombastus.
Although that's very close to Bubastus, which is actually the Egyptian cat god.
Even better. And you can call him Boom Boom.
Torin,
instead of Bom Bom.
My friend Torin Atkinson had a cat named Bubastus. Friend and co-host on Caustic Soda, the aforementioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't have a tail.
Oh.
Little no-tail Bubastus. Tell her she can go, that I free her. Make her leave. Make her go away.
Mm.
I signed a book for you once, didn't I? Oh, God, please. I don't know why this doctor does this, but I guess he does. He goes and says, is there anyone here? He says, Rick, you're free to go. Hello? And all that's there is Here Comes a Candle by Erasmus Fry. And we find out that the blurb is, she was his muse and the slave of his lust.
Yep.
That was his favorite little book.
Yeah, I don't understand why the doctor would choose to do that. Like, he has a patient who's obviously having a psychotic episode
mm-hmm.
in his house, and he chooses to leave him alone in his house.
I don't think that is that
his
house.
Office.
I think that's his office.
Yeah,
it's Felix Garrison, FRC.
Still, mm-hmm. that seems like a dangerous place to leave somebody.
Yeah.
Who is potentially, he is self-harming because he ripped his fingers apart.
Yeah, I'm going to guess, we haven't seen it, he probably left him with somebody in somebody's care.
Mm.
Right?
He was,
I mean,
also
this
trying
is
to give him
shorthanded, right? Like, we can't see everything.
Yeah, he needed
here,
it for
sure.
The story for him mm-hmm. to go here, but it is a little strange.
And then we have Calliope and Dream together. And Calliope's looking much better. She's wearing classic Greek garb, a chiton. And her hair is up in a classical manner as well.
Mm-hmm. Her hair is did.
Mm-hmm.
You have changed, Oneiros. In the old days, you would have left me to rot forever without turning a hair. Do you still hate me for what I did?
No, I no longer hate you, Calliope. I have learned much in recent times, and no matter. I do not hate you, child.
I think you should release the mortal now. He has set me free.
If that is what you wish, it is done. He lets her make the call.
Yeah.
He's like, torture, torture, torture. And he seems to be like, psh, I can keep it up. That seems to be implied, yeah. Right? What, do you want me to just keep it up for however long he had you? Because Dream's nasty.
I mean, I think that he would eventually just kill himself, right? Like,
oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, just drive him mad until he kills himself. But.
And she tries to offer, maybe I could visit you. And he says, I do not think that would be a good idea, Calliope.
Hmm.
Which is, you know, sometimes it's a good idea to just not hang out with your exes. I mean, you can be friendly and decent to each other, but you don't have to hang out.
Yeah. Also, he might be being like, I think you need to do some growing and stuff, and I might
have
not be the right person
have
to
some
lean
you time.
On. Yeah. Also, they've both just escaped imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
He has just gone through something, and he's thinking both of them who've just both kind of had their own large traumas shouldn't be relying on each other to get over their traumas to help move past that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, they've both just experienced something traumatic, and it would maybe be too, it would not be healthy for two people who have recently been traumatized to kind of re-traumatize each other.
I think maybe Jed might have reminded him of Calliope. Because I think when he escaped, he probably pretty much knew.
Mm.
Right, that she was held. I mean, somebody would have let him know eventually. I don't think it's a great secret.
No.
The three all knew. They might have told him. Mm-hmm. But he didn't go rescue her right away. But in the doll's house, Dream realizes he wasn't exactly right about some stuff. And
yeah.
There's confusing things that he didn't understand. And I think he might have felt a little better about, you know, he said Jed will return to the waking world. And it's bad what's happened to you and things like that. And
yeah.
I think this might be that next step after that.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you see him fade away and Richard Maddox's ideas are gone. All of them. He's got no idea anymore. No idea at all. And the implication is he's never going to have another creative idea in his life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be his...
He's done.
His muse is gone and... Morpheus, who is also a, you know, the dream god, the other source mm-hmm. of inspiration for ideas,
is
all, both of them are like, fuck you, man.
Yeah, fuck you.
Yeah.
Also, what I think is neat here is that in this, you have Richard rambling on, mm-hmm. and Felix, the doctor, Dr. Felix, is not really listening to him. And to me, that seems to, it feels like it mirrors the conversation that Richard had with Erasmus a little bit, where Erasmus is going on and on and on, and Felix mm-hmm. doesn't care. He's mm-hmm. not listening to him. He's not interested. And the doctor is saying, you know, like, well, you can take this book with you to the hospital. Like, I found this book there. There was no girl, and you can yeah. take it to the hospital. So he's not listening to the things that Richard is saying. He's mm-hmm. focused on, I'm a doctor, you are hurt, and I don't really want you around anymore, and I'm going to send you to the hospital. Yeah.
Next issue, A Dream of a Thousand Cats. Ugh, I've been waiting for you to read this story for so long.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it?
This is another standalone.
They're all cats. Everybody, all these characters that we know and love,
yeah,
they're all cats.
So there's going to be Calliope Cat?
What are you talking about? Well, Dream is definitely a cat.
Okay, Dream Cat.
Yeah. Matt is there.
Matthew the Raven.
Mm-hmm. He's still a raven, not a cat.
Okay.
And...
Is he a cat raven?
Nope, just a raven.
Okay.
Probably annoyed at all the cats.
Okay.
And maybe Dream... is going to show... Oh, these are all standalones. Okay, so Dream's not, like, got to be a key player. So it's mostly about other cats. Maybe it's going to be about a cat god that I don't know the name of, and then Dream
Bast is a cat god.
Yeah. Bast.
Maybe also known as Bubastis.
Bubastis.
But Bast.
And maybe Bast is a cat god, and Dream is going to... Goddess. Deity. Deity. And Dream is going to show up there and... I don't know. Do something.
And what?
Do something. I don't know. What do cats dream about? Well, I think that mundane, everyday cats dream about different things than, like, god cats.
It's going to be 1,000 cats. Dream of 1,000 cats. So are the cats dreaming about?
World domination.
Okay. So it's going to be cat dream.
Yeah.
And the cat's going to be dreaming about world domination.
Yeah.
And there's going to be cat goddess or cat deity.
Yeah.
As well.
Yes.
We'll have to find out next episode. You've been dreaming of the Sandman, issue 17, Calliope. For show notes, visit thedreaming.motivedust.com. Support future episodes at patreon.com/thedreaming. Like us on Facebook. Rate and review us on your favorite podcast app, including Google Play Music and iTunes. Our theme music is Oneri by Kai Engel. Hear more at kaiengel.bandcamp.com. The Dreaming was recorded in Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada, on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, Kikate, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. I'm Joe Fulgham. Thanks for listening. Time to wake up.